This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
I'm going to look at staffing and offshore activities, basically. That means on the campuses, and you heard this morning a figure of about 200 established, and about 10 to 15 at the moment staffed by UK, and also TNE, transnational educational activities. So, well, we're interested in answering several questions relating to how all those activities are staffed. This is a result of a research project which I've just completed and is about going to be launched in the beginning of April, with funded, as you see, by the International and Europe unit and by the Leadership Foundation yet again. And I had a mixed team. Because the case studies embrace both Australia and US, I had two authors who helped me visit those. The actual study is based on these nine case studies here. And I thank very much indeed three of you in the room for helping me, Colin, Christine, and Drummond, who's now left. Inevitably, I looked at their activities and drew on them. The others you will see, Newcastle, for example, the new venture they've got in Iskandar in Malaysia, RMIT Vietnam, a long-established campus there, Texas A&M in Qatar, also quite long-established, UCL's two very new interesting exercises in Australia and Kazakhstan, and then reasonably long-established one in Dubai. So it's quite an interesting mix of the world. And for all those, we were seeking to answer some of these questions. How on earth do you staff them? What mix of staff do you use over what time? What are the sort of problems and issues that you have to face when you're doing the staffing? What do the staff think about it? What's their perceptions about working offshore? How do you reward them? And what do you do about quality? This whole problem of delivering the same standard at a distance. How can you possibly maintain it? And what are the implications for staff? Then finally, what do you do about research? Well, we all know the context, and we've talked about it for most of this morning. And the issue is that we're expecting people to go offshore, either a short-term flying faculty, usually that means delivering some teaching activities, quite frequently compressed for a very short time, a module over, for example, a period of a week or 2 weeks. We're sometimes asking for longer-term secondments, people up sticks with their family expecting to move and live. We're frequently calling for short-term collaborative travel for research supervisors and collaborators, and then a whole host of other people we may ask to travel for short-term again, staff development where we're in the capacity building project, quality assurance if we're keen to obviously monitor the partner's provision, and then administrative support as well. We want our administrators quite often to understand the partner's structures and culture. So we have a lot of people who will be involved in one form or another offshore. Trying to sort of classify this in some sort of way, we find really ourselves dealing with three types of staff. There's our home campus staff, and we'll talk a bit more about them because clearly your policy is mostly related to them. They're the staff of the national partner, and in almost all cases, even where we have an offshore campus, which is nominally ours, we have an offshore partner. And they're what I loosely call international staff. They're staff recruited on the open market who work on our activity offshore. And for each of the categories I've shown down the left of this overhead, we will draw on different types or different mixes of those three staff. And the issues we've got to face, I think, are the policies for those three kinds of staff and who fixes them where and how and what they are. My asterisks are just an attempt to try and sort of show the approximate weighting of numbers. I mean, for example, in a wholly owned campus, of the nine case studies we looked at, we could get statistics from seven. And from the seven activities, only 7% of the staff working in those activities were from the UK. So the great bulk of staffing came either from the national partner or from the international market. So we had a relatively small element. Where we have a joint venture, the same kind of thing happened, but we rely, of course, almost extensively on the partner, our academic partner, to do delivery. And likewise, where we have a franchise or validated provision, and where we have research, it's quite often it's a simple one-to-one and an equal relationship. So the staff involvement will vary very much by category. And we found that issues obviously vary by category. Thinking about the flying faculty, it's probably too early to generalise, but I think it's true to say there's increasing reluctance to fly regularly. I would put continue flying regularly. There's a correlation, I suspect, with the mission group. It's harder to get this to work in research-intensive universities. Ian Gow, formerly running the Nottingham, the Nottingham campus in Ningbo, wrote about this about 3 years ago and said how difficult it was to get researchers in Nottingham to move. And indeed, it's quite difficult even to get people to move for short term as well from other institutions. So there may be a correlation that it's easier to get them in non-research intensives than it is in research intensives. I'm not sure. One of the issues probably relates to what the staff contract says. Several universities are moving to saying, we will employ you to work globally. You can't say we only want to work in the UK. Your contract is going to be reworded to cover, to make it easier for us to ask you to work offshore. That's not happening widely, but at least in one of our case study institutions, that's taking place. Now, that doesn't mean that they can instruct their academics to move. No sensible employer would ever do that. But it at least would make it a little bit easier to get the mobility that you want. How much do you reward flying faculty, if at all? Do you say to them, it's your job to teach for 2 weeks over there, we're not going to pay you anymore? One of our case studies, the American one, Texas A&M, paid their flying faculty $5,000 a week as a reward because they demanded consultancy type payments to doing it. That may well become what you have to do. That again could depend on the discipline. If you're in a business school or business faculty, you're most likely to ask for $5,000. There are many barriers to flying faculty moving, and I just list a few of them here. They will want cover for their teaching while they're away. They may not want to move for personal reasons. They may find the quality of the teaching and the facilities, and indeed the accommodation in the partner institutions, pretty awful. I did a case study last year of a university where in the Chinese partner institution, the accommodation was so grotty that there literally were rats running around in the bedrooms, and the message soon got around, and people did not want to go and stay in the university hostels in that particular partner. UCU, of course, is very keen on this kind of thing. Intensity of teaching can be an issue. These things are only economic quite often if you parcel a whole module into 2 weeks, and that can be a very heavy burden for someone who's not used to teaching 8 hours a day for 10 days. So you've got to consider that. who is? So these are some of the issues that you would have to face, I think. With a longer-term staff, if you're going to ask people to move for a year, 2 years, you've got to consider the role. In the studies we looked at, it was usually the case that a university wanting to create a new campus or new activity would send out the top people, and that they would be from the home campus, and their job would be to set it up and then after a while quietly disappear and hand over to either an international manager or a national staff person. There was one institution used the term culture carrier. We want our people to be there as culture carriers, to set the tone, to try and get our own culture understood offshore. Another, a key issue, I think, and you will have to face this across the board, is where the HR management decisions are taken. Is it, should the UK HR department, as it were, try and fix salaries, fix conditions, understand the basis on which its staff are working throughout the world? Most multinationals might do this. Some might say our local subsidiary has total autonomy to do what it likes. There's one British university here where when I spoke to the HR director, he said, I don't know what pay or what terms and conditions the people on our offshore campuses are getting. I haven't a clue. That's up to the local board. Now, is that good practice? I don't know. I would hope that there's some synergy between what happens locally and what happens at home. If there's mobility between the two campuses, that would certainly be necessary. But I think you want to be sure, if you have a partner as well, what the role of the partner is in setting the salaries, the benefits, the pay, etc. And if that's through a local board, what the relationship of those decisions are to your own HR decisions. And who exactly, basically, are these people accountable to? So really, these decisions on pay and conditions and payroll means raising questions of local comparability. In many countries, there are sometimes three different salary scales for the offshore activities. Home domestic staff were there for short term. The locally employed academic staff were there on local conditions, and the international staff, who more often than not are employed on the same sort of terms as the UK staff, but not always. So how you, whether you have those three or whether you try and rationalise is very much a key issue. We ask people about what they actually paid in terms of cash and also in terms of benefits. And a surprising number were quite willing to tell us, not cash terms, but about the benefits, and they're recorded in the study when you see it. And this sort of summarises the position as regards resident longer-term staff, the people whom you send out for 1 or 2 years. And the benefits are becoming really very global and sort of market sensitive for obvious reasons. It's an international world, it's a competitive international world, and if you're advertising globally in all the newspapers, you've got to sometimes pay to get the best rates. One of our case studies, however, has a real hair shirt mentality, and it was RMIT in Vietnam, where they pay no benefits whatsoever, give a 4-week holiday and pay on local salary scales. And somehow they say, we have an ethos, which means we can attract the young, bright, sensitive academic. Well, we'll see. I don't know how it works. But most institutions have to play the market game. You'll see from the case study when you read it that the RMIT is, Vietnam is mildly unbelievable, I think, but given the rhetoric they claim to be able to achieve. Anyway, as you see from looking there, they're becoming quite commercial. Airfares, home, medical, school fees, etc., etc. And the last bullet is quite important, that people increasingly are expecting some form of cultural induction or introduction to the country and possibly even a language training if they're going to spend a time there. The sort of concerns that staff have, we picked up these points, really. You're so often dependent on your academic partner in the country concern to do a lot of the employment-related matters. That means the immigration, the regulation and the tax, etc. I think, as Drummond's listed some of the issues this morning, if you can't rely on that partner to do it properly, you will have some unhappy people. Staff also get concerned quite obviously about some of the national cultural issues, and particularly in the Gulf or even in China, and what the bloomers are, what mistakes they could make, and how to behave. A month ago, the Times Higher had an article from someone who had been teaching in Ningbo, putting down what her concerns were, the three T's. And there she summarised that the real worries were linguistic and cultural and understanding the Chinese context. Limitations to academic freedom is obviously part of the Ningbo situation as well, and people will have to learn how to teach and how to get the best out of their students in a different environment. And then finally, there may be concerns about IPR if you are in an environment where research is a realistic possibility. Two final areas, from the concerns that the unions have, which really echo some of the staff concerns that I mentioned earlier. These were all reported in a guide that they put out for their staff, which came out last year. And again, the second bullet is quite interesting. They may ask you for an exit strategy. I can imagine if anyone had been working in Libya 3 weeks ago, they would have been somewhat interested in that as well. But you may need to think about not only the physical emergency exit, but also the longer-term view of the staffing strategy for that particular partnership or offshore activity. And the final topic is quality. How do you get, how do you help your staff to ensure that the quality of what is being delivered is either the same as or comparable to? There will be local situations and probably local contextual elements in the curriculum which might make it impossible to have it identical, but it should certainly seek to make it comparable. And here are some of the issues that would influence the policy. What exactly it is that you're delivering, whose award it is, how able the partner is in terms of its maturity and the quality of its staff, what you've decided the student experience is to be, as I said, is it to be identical or consistent, and the implications of the national QA regime and how it should mesh with your own, as we've just heard. There are various ways in which our partner institutions, or case study institutions rather, tackle this. Having a very clear understanding at the outset what the quality strategy was to be, whose responsibility with the partner, respective roles of the two agencies, your own QAA and the national agency. To have plans for staff development and mentoring for partner staff if necessary. To involve the faculty offices and your own home support activities. I was very impressed when I visited staff at Surrey, for example, that in the faculty concerned, at least three or four of the support staff knew quite well their opposite partners there and had visited them and were in daily telephone and Skype contact with them. They were in the student support arena, in the educational development of the faculty office, and they were able to talk regularly with their Chinese partners. So I think once you have that kind of backing, it is much easier to get internal processes between the two institutions or between you and the campus that are compatible and meet both the two sets of quality assurance requirements. And some of the tricks that institutions use in the case studies are link tutors, regular travelling between the institutions, double marking of by the home faculty of the offshore programmes, and then regular contact. So what are the main messages? I think if you are thinking about staffing, it's not something you do as a once-off strategy. You've got to think about a five-year plan. How long are your home staff going to be there? What is your reliance going to be on the international market or the domestic market in the country concerned? Will you replace one with the other over time? And what will the respective mix of staffing be? Where will the policies be made? Who will fix it? Can you have a consistent international policy, or do you delegate and have different models for different countries? You must get things sorted out for your own people before they go. In one of our case study institutions, Newcastle, for example, has a very nice set of international HR policies for short-term staff and for long-term staff, all written down, and then that is negotiated and talked through with anybody who wants to travel. And clearly, as Drummond mentioned this morning, if your staff are going to be based offshore, you've got to have a really full understanding of that country's HR and employment policies. And that is a key part of the due diligence. There was one of our case studies found that its due diligence for all, before it set up the campus offshore, all the professional studies, both legal, HR and others, absorbed £700,000 worth of cost. So it can be a very major investment to get yourself really in the right position to go ahead with a significant offshore investment. And finally, you need a strategy for integrating the two quality assurance policies and procedures. So those are some of the key messages for setting up offshore in either a campus or a major TNE partnership. They'll all be in the report which I referred to at the beginning, which is due out on April the 7th. Look forward to seeing you there at the launch. Thank you.